This is The God Show, a conversation about the human spirit with your host, Pat McMahon.
Hi, everybody, wherever you are on the planet, I'm telling you this is going to be something that possibly could change your life or, like happened to me when I was reading Colleen Carroll Campbell's book. I kept thinking about all of the people that I knew that she seemed to know because her experiences were very much like a lot of people that I know now and have known in the past because they too sought perfection as Colleen has. I gave up years ago. Name of the book is The Heart of Perfection. And subtitled, How the Saints Taught Me to Trade My Dream of Perfect for God's. And what an intriguing read it has been, Colleen. Welcome to The God Show.
Thanks so much for having me, Pat.
Absolutely, as I welcomed everybody around the world, because this is an international audience, I wonder if it has ever occurred to you to do any research on the worldwide aspects of the search for perfection. Is it the same in Australia or Ghana as it was in your house growing up?
Well, that is a big question, and I have to admit I haven't done that sort of research. But The Heart of Perfection does weave my own journey with those of these seven, what I call recovering perfectionist saints, and they were mostly confined to Europe, but certainly in all different ages, in all different kinds of cultures and families. So I do think in some sense this is a universal problem, a universal challenge.
Back, as your eyes are getting heavy, Colleen, go back, back to another time and another age. I don't know when that age was, but you're going to tell me about the first time someone called you a perfectionist.
You know, it's funny. I don't know if I can remember that because I never saw this as a problem that I had. I never identified as a perfectionist. I really thought that was a different kind of person. They were extremely uptight. They didn't have senses of humor. They alphabetized their CDs. They color-coded their socks. You could eat off their kitchen floor. It was that kind of person. And I'm not that kind of person. You know, I like to have fun. I have a sense of humor. I could relax. So I figured I'm not a perfectionist. And I only really realized that I was. Now, I was always an overachiever, and I was always a striver when it came to school and work. So, I mean, looking back, I probably was wearing the perfectionist label for others to see long before I recognized it myself. But it was really only when I became mother 9 years ago, that's when I became aware of the fact that, A, I was a perfectionist, and B, it was going to be a real problem with motherhood.
But that was when you first became aware of it. I asked you the first time someone called you or thought of you as a perfectionist. I'm sure that they didn't keep it a secret all those years.
Well, again, I don't recall the label, but I'd certainly been called an overachiever. I remember somebody when I was 25 saying, you know, your next career move is going to be a midlife crisis. I mean, I was writing my resume when I was in elementary school, before most kids even knew what the word meant. I was spell checking my high school boyfriend's love letters. So, you know, obviously I was not completely aware probably that I was a perfectionist, but I'm sure others were, including that poor fellow who had to, you know, get his love letters returned. He told me he appreciated it, at least until we broke up. So.
It was the next, and he also went into the seminary. but I was going to bring up the love letters to your boyfriend as the next thing I was going to talk about, because no matter how much of a person in denial you might have been then, the reality is you actually did correct his love letters and send them back.
Well, you know, he was struggling. He wasn't the greatest speller. He was an awesome hockey player, but spelling was not his forte. He'd write that I was beautiful, B-U-T-I-F-U-L, and I just, you know, the grammarian in me just couldn't hack it. So, you know, I went on to become an English major and then a journalist and then an author. So I guess you know, you're dealing with a word person. So, yeah, I'm sure that was pretty insufferable. But he did thank me I don't know. You know, I had these tendencies. Obviously, you know, and I was always striving for my A pluses, and if I didn't get the A plus plus, I was kind of beating myself up. I definitely had these tendencies. And my parents saw them in me. They would tell me to relax, don't worry about it so much, you know. And I tried to, but you know, there is, I think, at least in me, there was this drive that I wanted to do my very best. I wanted excellence. And I don't think that's entirely a bad thing. And sometimes I think in our cultural conversation about perfectionism, that's what gets lost, this sense that wanting to be excellent, wanting to achieve something is somehow a negative, that we just have to squelch that idealism. And I don't think we have to. And that's part of why I wrote The Heart of Perfection, because at least when we bring this into our spiritual lives, our relationship with God, it isn't all negative. It's just where we take that longing and where we start forming our ideas of perfect as opposed to God's idea. That's where we get into trouble. At least that's where I got into trouble.
Well, I'm really glad, though, that you brought that up, as thousands upon thousands of people in our audience are right now listening to you describe them. They're all saying, oh, wait a minute, hold it. Now I understand what Colleen Carol Campbell is talking about. She's talking about me. But if you're talking about also being categorized as a perfectionist, as you just alluded to, it is kind of a compliment, isn't it?
It can be. You know, it's kind of the answer we all give, the stock answer in a job interview. Oh, what's your weakness? Oh, I'm a bit of a perfectionist. And we all kind of wink. We all kind of think of that as a compliment. And it's only, I think, in recent years in our larger cultural conversation that we've come to recognize there's something pretty toxic about perfectionism, whether it's in work or parenting or anything else, and certainly in the spiritual life. But again, I think sometimes we think we have to throw the baby out with the bathwater. Well, I just have to stop having any ideals, any desire to be better and grow closer to God and grow in virtue, whatever it is. And I don't think that's what the, and certainly not what I learned from these recovering perfectionist saints, who were amazing people with very diverse personalities, lots of flaws and lots of their own perfectionist quirks. But they achieved a level of interior freedom that I think few of us would say we've achieved. And they did so precisely by grappling with the perfectionist problem and beginning to look at it in an entirely new light.
All right, but being closer to the image of God and his qualities might be an overly ambitious task. let's just talk about one of the family members. Is it not an absolute compliment to be thought of as Christ-like? And isn't that perfection?
Well, certainly for a Christian, that's what we're aiming for. I mean, we're aiming to follow in the footsteps of Jesus. We're not going to achieve it fully in this life, that's for sure. But I think where we can get confused is we naturally tend to interpret that as flawlessness. And so we're kind of white knuckling our way to flawlessness, whether it's in our prayer routine, in the way we're raising our kids, in the way we deal with difficult relatives or coworkers, whatever it is. And then what can happen for a spiritual perfectionist is you start beating yourself up every time you recognize the gap between yourself and who you want to be, between this weakness that you see in yourself and this strength that you want to acquire, whether it's moral strength or spiritual strength, whatever it is. And so that desire for flawlessness, again, it's sort of a natural thing as human beings. We want to shed our flaws. We want to soar. But I think a lot of times, at least in the case of the recovering perfectionist saints, what God was calling them to was not flawlessness, but often humility, a willingness to recognize their weakness and allow him to work through that weakness and allow him to gradually heal that weakness, not to heal it overnight. And in our world today where, you know, everyone's showing everything on social media and we're constantly comparing ourselves to others, you know, we want to be fixed overnight. We want to be who we wanted to be right now. And really, at least in the case of the lives of these saints that I wrote about in The Heart of Perfection, that's generally not how God works. He does tend to work in a slower, more gradual way, in a way that isn't always going to draw the applause from the crowd.
Now, we've talked about saints many times in the 17 years that we've been doing this show, and we're going to be talking about them again, because that is a fundamental part of The Heart of Perfection, the book by Colleen Carol Campbell, our guest on The God Show. But I want to know about her. I want to know about that girl before she became a woman who was still getting report cards and disappointed if she got an A-, which tends to cause me to take a little Pepto-Bismol while I'm talking to you. I want to know how you grew up. Tell me about the family.
Well, I had a very loving family. My parents were very affirming of me. And I think sometimes there's a sense that if you're a perfectionist, it's because you had some parent over your shoulder screaming at you every time you made a mistake. That wasn't my experience. There are folks in this book, In the Heart of Perfection, who had that kind of parent, and that can certainly contribute to it. But I did have a very affirming, loving family, very faith-filled. And the religion that I grew up with, I grew up Catholic. I was not, in my home at least, it was not all about judgment or severity or rules. So I didn't get that. And I think that in some ways can make this tricky, because you can think, well, a spiritual perfectionist must be someone who was goaded into guilt from a very young age, smacked with the ruler by, you know, the stereotypical old nun or whatever it is. And I didn't have that. Not at all. In fact, the churches and schools of my childhood, everything was God is love and a felt banner and kumbaya. We weren't getting a lot of doom and gloom and judgment. But perfectionism does run in families, and it ran in mine. And I think this is common to families. I know my mom to being a perfectionist, and her mother was a perfectionist par excellence. I mean, my grandmother had 12 kids, and she, you know, maintained this beautiful house and stunning figure, and she marched them into mass every morning before they went to mass at school, and she made her own whole wheat bread because she didn't like the Wonder Bread they were offering in the 50s, and, you know, everything was to a T, and she was like that all the way into her 90s. You know, you try to make dinner with her, and I loved her. She was a great character. She was a generous, wonderful woman, but, I mean, you know, you'd feel like a, you know, you're with the drill sergeant when you messed up. And so I think she was very hard on herself, and she loved her family, but I think she probably was also trying to live up to this image in her head of what she had to be, I think, worthy of love, to be worthy of this vocation of motherhood or whatever it is. And I think for me, at least, so I do see these strains of perfectionism in my family background. I see it in the culture, for sure. I mean, women, I think, especially, but men as well, you know, we're given a very clear sense of what we need to achieve in every area of our lives to be considered a success. And, you know, we can drive ourselves pretty hard. And sometimes the faith that we look to comfort us, we actually then start seeing all of the expectations there, and it could just be overwhelming. But I think at the root of my spiritual perfectionism was really a sense that I had to be worthy of God's love. I had to earn God's love. Again, my parents never told me this. I didn't hear this in church growing up. I would have, in fact, told you, oh, no, that's not right. That's not how it works. But I was still living like I believe that. And I think many of us today are. We'll say, you know, oh, no, I know God loves me unconditionally, blah, blah, blah. But day to day, are we really living like we believe that? Because I know for many years I was not living like I really believed that. And I don't want to give the impression I'm fully recovered, but I think I'm a little further along the way just for having recognized that this is a problem in my life.
But Colleen, you and I both grew up in the same faith. And I'm hearing you talk about this God is love background that you had on Sunday mornings at Mass. How did you avoid Our Lady of Perpetual Guilt? That's the parish I went to.
Well, I think the church probably was different in different eras. I mean, in my childhood, we're talking the 80s, and if anything, things were so vague that a lot of my friends and I didn't even know what was going on. We didn't know what the doctrine was. We weren't even sure who we were supposed to worship. I mean, it was pretty vague. Now, I won't say that about my parents. In my parents' home, they were reading John of the Cross and Teresa of Avila, and we were pretty well formed in our Catholic faith. But again, it wasn't for me, and I know there are Catholics who grew up with that experience, but at least in my time, and in fact, of most of the people I grew up with around the time I was going to Catholic schools and Catholic churches, that was not the problem. If anything, it was a little bit the other direction. But that's interesting, because that too can be an issue. If kids do grow up, sometimes you can be rather, you know, kind of vaguely in a faith or nothing at all. You can be, you know, kind of a spiritual seeker and still have some struggles in this area, because I think this is part of our human nature, this sense that how could God love me unconditionally if I didn't do anything to deserve that? Who loves like that? How could God not be out to punish me and get me when I fall, when I screw up? Because that's what human beings, that's how human beings respond when you offend them, right? So, you know, some of this absolutely can come from the milieu that you're in. I'm not denying that. But I do think there's something deep within us as fallen, flawed human beings that just tends to view God through the same small little lens that we view other people. And we think he's just a bigger version of us, but just as petty and just as spiteful and just as judgmental. And thank the Lord that he's not, because I would not want to worship a God who is just as weak and short-sighted as I can be sometimes.
If the name Colin Carroll Campbell sounds familiar, you may have read her across the United States and around the world in the New York Times, the Washington Post, Christianity Today, St. Louis Post-Dispatch. You may be familiar with her name and her voice. And if you could see her face, because she's been on every television network at one time or another, short of Netflix. And with all of that experience, she discovered where this concept of perfectionism came from and what place it deserves in any of our lives. How did you begin to study the saints?
Well, I had fallen in love with the saints many years before. I was raised with stories of the saints, and I was into them as a kid. Then I became a teenager and thought they were irrelevant goody-goodies, and I wasn't interested in their stories. And then at the very end of my college years, when I was struggling with some really deep spiritual hunger and some questions about, you know, here I'm striving for all this success and I'm living the party lifestyle. I'm doing what the world says I have to do to feel good, to be free, to be successful. And I'm bored and I'm empty. And I'm increasingly just looking at my life and not, you know, just feeling a little bit lost. And at that time, my father gave me a copy of an old biography of Teresa of Avila by the French writer Marcel Auclair.
Mm-hmm.
And it was this amazing book, which I would have never opened, except my parents had just moved to a new city. I was on break from Christmas break, didn't have any friends around, so I had to, you know, I had nothing better to do but read this book. And I was captivated by Teresa of Avila. Here was this woman who, my image of a saint, goody-goody, never did anything wrong, never struggled. And she was so far from that. She was in her 40s before she sort of got her act together, spiritually speaking. She was constantly struggling with vanity, with an attraction to, you know, just anything that was kind of frivolous. She was a social butterfly, great gifts with people, but often that distracted her so much from anything deeper in her life. So she had this deep hunger for God, but also this fear that if she grew too close to him, he was going to demand too much of her. He was going to take away her freedom. And when I read this story of Teresa of Avila, this 16th century nun who felt like a friend I had just met down the hall at the dorm, I thought, wow, okay, I didn't know that the saints could be so real and could have struggled so long. Again, Teresa was in her 40s when she really embarked in her life's work. She became a great Carmelite mystic and a reformer and an author of some of the greatest spiritual books ever written in the Christian tradition. And that really opened my eyes to the fact that this search that I had embarked upon, this longing for a deeper kind of freedom, was not new, and I didn't have to reinvent the wheel. And there were actually people in my tradition as a Catholic who had been on this voyage before and come out the other side more liberated, closer to God, but also more joyful and fully themselves, not bland, not boring, not straitjacketed. And that was the beginning. And so I wrote my last book, My Sisters the Saints, was a memoir that chronicled my journey through infertility and through my father's long battle with Alzheimer's disease and the six women saints who really helped me on that journey. But when it came time to write this new one, The Heart of Perfection, as I began to grapple with perfectionism, I thought, okay, now this is one topic where I think I better steer clear of the saints because they can't help me here. They're spiritual overachievers. I don't want to be reading them. They're just going to trigger me. And so I was really surprised to find that as I dug into some of their stories that, in fact, this was a common problem with the saints. And that gave me hope, and it also surprised me. So I wanted to share what I had learned with others who struggle with this as well.
Your journey through infertility that you write about in the book was painful, but was resolved as I opened the book to discover Clara Colleen, John Patrick, thank you very much.
That's your name, there you go.
Yeah. Joseph Francis, Mary Rose Therese. And you say that this really had to be the anchor that began the transition from the pre-maternal Colleen to being a mother.
Right. Yeah, well, I mean, when I became a mother is when the perfectionism problem came to light. And it's also when I began to reflect on, okay, where did I get this? And am I going to pass this on to my children? Because as parents, you know, we're always going to make mistakes and we're going to always pass on some ideas and attitudes we didn't mean to. But I was realizing that one of the most dangerous ones that I might pass on, one of the biggest mistakes I might make, was the constant beating myself up for mistakes. That ironically, in trying so hard to be this wonderful, perfect mother, because I'd waited so long for these babies and they were such a gift from God, and boy, I really don't want to screw this one up, that I was actually putting so much pressure on my children and on myself that it was stealing my joy in motherhood. And it was actually affecting the kind of mother I was becoming. I wasn't going to be able to enjoy my children, to enjoy motherhood, and to instill in them this boundless trust in God's mercy and love if I wasn't living that in my own life. And it's interesting, as I began to study perfectionism more, I found that one thing the researchers all agree on is that perfectionism does run in families. Some say it's more nature, some say it's more nurture, but either way, this is something that parents will pass on to their children if they don't recognize it and grapple with it themselves. Now, there may be some perfectionism we're all going to just pass on, it's part of the human condition, but we really can make a difference in our families and in our circles, in our communities, in our faith communities, when we recognize this and say, I'm gonna deal with this so I don't just hand this on to the next generation and leave them to deal with this. And so that was a real impetus for me to seek healing, was because I realized that it was going to affect my children and the kind of mother I became. And I, you know, precisely because I wanted to be a good mother, I wanted to find some freedom from those crushing expectations of what that meant to be this great mother who, you know, beats herself up for every mistake. I didn't want to be that person.
Even though you and I have both met and spent some time, perhaps even less than they expected, some time with perfectionist parents, I've never been able to understand how they could combine those realities, that is, parenting and perfectionism, because to me, being a parent is the most humbling experience I've ever had in my life. You describe walking in the door, Colleen, I jumped out of the chair last night when I opened the book to this passage, when you walk in the house and you've got a child in your arms, but the nurses are still back in the hospital and so is the doctor. And we all have said the same thing, particularly with that first child. What the hell am I going to do now?
Right. And in my case, we had two.
Yes. Surprise.
No. No, parenting is very humbling. And my parents were certainly humble and aware they were making mistakes. But I think, again, it can be tempting to think, well, a perfectionist parent, okay, that's the one who thinks they're doing it all right. That's not me. But actually, I think it's more the case, at least in today's culture, that the perfectionist parent is the one constantly beating herself up or himself up for things that are real mistakes sometimes. Yeah, I really did handle that the wrong way. I really, you know, maybe I disciplined too sternly, or I snapped too much, or I wasn't present enough at bedtime, or whatever it is, you know, or something bigger. But it's that question of, do we get stuck there on who I wanted to be and then what I failed to do and then I'm going to punish myself? Or do we really see that as the open door for grace, that is precisely where God wants to enter in with us, enter into our journey, that he's, in a sense, you know, we think we're raising these kids and schooling them, but they're really schooling us.
Oh, yes.
And God uses them. He uses them to, yes, show us our weakness, but also to get us leaning on him, opening our hearts to his grace and recognizing, okay, I love this child more than anything in the world, but Lord, you love this child even more. And therefore, give me what you want me to have for this child. And where I fail, please come into the gaps and fill those spaces where I can't do everything right because I'm just a human being. And I think where we open our hearts more to his grace is where we see the real miracles of healing begin. You know, they're quiet miracles. It's not earth-shattering stuff, but it's important stuff about healing our own wounds from childhood and allowing our children to grow up knowing that, yeah, you're going to mess up in life and you're going to have failures, but God is going to be with you because he loves you and I love you. And even when I'm imperfect, you have another heavenly parent who loves you perfectly, just the way you need to be loved. I think that's a good thing for a child to realize growing up, that I do have someone who's got my back, even when mom or dad dropped the ball.
In the Heart of Perfection, you use as examples the lives of seven saints. And it recalled, as I was reading the book, a time in my life when I was in Rome, and I was standing alone, but obviously it must have been early on a weekday, because it is rare when there aren't crowds in the piazza that is St. Peter's Square, in front of the Basilica, usually right. Jammed with people. And even if the Pope isn't making an appearance, there's always a huge number of people. But if you're standing there and you look around at the sculptures, and these are the saints that surround you, elevated on arches, circling this piazza in one of the most famous places of worship in the world. And yet, if you look closely at some of the sculptures, you also notice there are cracks in the stone. And you call our attention in each case to the flaws of those saints. Pursue that, please.
Yes, well, that's where, again, I think God's grace entered in and made them saints. And for me, that was something of a revelation, because I loved the saints, as I said. I had seen that they could be relevant to my life, but I had thought when it came to perfectionism, they were all about white-knuckled striving, so if I wanted to get past that, they were not who I needed to look to. But when I took a second look at them, I noticed that in every single case of the seven recovering perfectionist saints that I write about in the Heart of Perfection, it was when they gave up on the striving and traded it for surrender. That's when the holiness begins. That's when you start to see the fruit of their lives really blossom. That's when they start to grow into the person that they become known as. And so the problem sometimes with our hagiographies is we remember who they became and we forget where they began. Mm-hmm. And we forget that their struggles along the way were not all that different from ours. And sometimes we can think, well, all right, Benedict of Nursia, you know, 400, whatever. I mean, what is he going to have in common with me, or Ignatius of Loyola, or Teresa of Avila, you know, 500, 600 years ago? What are they going to have to say to me? And the amazing thing is quite a lot, because, you know, the human person, the fundamental questions of what it is to be a human being and the fundamental nature of human beings, it doesn't change. You know, there can be different struggles in different contexts, yes, but at the end of the day, we're all kind of looking for the same things. And so what I found is in each of these cases, I mean, the personalities were often wildly divergent, the circumstances, yes, but they were often dealing with some of the same things I've dealt with as a perfectionist. And one thing that's important to recognize with spiritual perfectionism is it doesn't always come in the same package. For each person, it can look a little different. It could look like anxiety, fear, constant discouragement, distraction, a tendency toward overcommitment because you're trying to do too much for God all at once. It can look a lot like a distorted image of God that needs to be healed. It can look like scrupulosity, beating yourself up for small sins or imaginary sins. It can take a lot of these different forms, and it took so many different forms in the lives of the saints, and so I found that really helpful to realize you could be born with any personality in any circumstance and struggle with this, and with God's grace, overcome it. At least that's the lesson I took from these saints.
Now, you mentioned a number of saints just in that passage of conversation, and yet you didn't mention the one saint of the seven that you write about that probably is best known, not just to Catholics, but to Protestants and Jews and Buddhists and non-participants, and that's St. Francis of Assisi. What was his flaw?
You know, it's interesting. I had always thought of Francis. We always remember him as kind of God's rebel, right? He's barefoot. He's a itinerant creature wandering the hillside of Italy, singing and talking to the birds and evangelical poverty. And he's this amazing man. And he was all of those things. But at least in my head, reading those little short snippets about him, I had always figured he had that kind of one and done conversion you read about. You know, he just sort of had that instant of, yes, I'm going to surrender everything to God. And then he becomes the great Francis of Assisi. And so it was interesting, the more I dug into his life story, that it wasn't one moment, but half a dozen moments over as many years, where he gradually gave over what today's researchers would call this a tendency towards social perfectionism. It's a fancy way of saying being overly concerned about what other people think of you, your reputation. And of course, we don't think of Francis of Assisi that way. We think of him as completely unconcerned with the world, countercultural. But for a very long time, he was a vain playboy who was the life of the party and was terrified of things like ending up with a hump on his back because he saw a gal in town who had a hunchback and he thought that was horrifying. And he was afraid of being laughed at. He was afraid of looking silly. He was okay with being a partier and he would give to the poor, but he drew the line at his own vanity and reputation. And that's what he had to overcome to become this man who then went on to revitalize the faith of the entire continent of Europe, basically, at least spark a revitalization through his own witness to the values of Christ that had gotten lost at that time period. And all that happened over a series of pretty gradual changes. You know, there was an encounter with a leper here. There was a vision or a dream there. It was things like that, where each time Francis had to decide if he was going to hold on to his social perfectionism, to protecting his reputation, to being reasonable in the eyes of the world, or was he going to let that go and step out in faith and follow Christ just one step further, one step further. And finally, we get to the point where we see him with the Bishop of Assisi confronting this father of his who wants all his stuff back, and the dad just wants him to be a respectable cloth merchant, and Francis takes off everything, and I mean everything, and leaves it at the feet of his father and marches off stark naked and begins what would eventually be known as, you know, the Franciscan Order. But even there, we forget that he didn't get a round of applause for that. For the first few years, he was alone, and he was a laughingstock in his hometown. He was begging from his own party pals who thought he was crazy. And it was a while before anyone started to follow him or see any sense in what he was doing. And the point of Francis for me is that when we are ready to begin to give up perfectionism, to allow God to show us our weakness and to recognize that weakness and admit it and seek forgiveness for the ways maybe we've hurt those we love through that, we have to be prepared for the fact that this is not necessarily going to gain us applause from the world. This isn't maybe going to be the way to upward mobility. And that can be a tough lesson, but I think that's what Francis shows us. The good news is that he died a man about as free as you could be, and joyful too. And he was a man who dealt with a lot of suffering, but his spirit was full of joy. You know, on his deathbed, he was singing so loud they told him to turn it down a bit, because they said, yeah, the townspeople think you're a saint, and they don't expect their saints to be singing so loudly. And he said, oh, no, I'm going to keep praising God as long as I can. So amazing person. But there again, he's not as different from us as we might suspect.
Of the infinite number of saints that have been presented to us over the centuries, you picked 7 for the Heart of Perfection. But Colleen Carroll Campbell, which one of the 7 did you most closely identify with?
You know, it would probably be Jane de Chantal. She was a 17th century French woman, noble woman, and partly just because my state in life right now, she was a mom of 4, and she was married. She was passionately in love with her husband. He was killed in a freak hunting accident the same week that she gave birth to their 4th child. So at age 29, she finds herself widowed with 4 children under age 6. She's got to move in with her father-in-law, who's this volatile old guy screaming at her all the time. He's carrying on this sordid affair with his housekeeper that's resulted in a bunch of kids who are now vying with Jane's kids for the family money. And at that day, you know, in those days, she couldn't just run off and get a job and be done with him. She had to live in this house and put up with this. And what I like about Jane is that she was a real striver, and she was pretty hardcore. She had very high standards for herself, high standards for others, high standards for her kids. And she was driving herself to exhaustion at one point in terms of her prayer routine. She was doing all these penances, trying to do all these elaborate fasts. She had found this spiritual director who was basically just prodding her way too hard. And here she is, this single mom. She's teetering on the brink of exhaustion. She starts to have doubts about the faith, more from exhaustion and just feeling, how could I ever live up to what God's asking of me? And in the midst of all this, really on the brink of a nervous breakdown, she meets her friend Francis de Sales. And he himself, as a recovering perfectionist, he had his own bout of perfectionism in college, and he begins to lead Jane on a new way. And he encourages her to let go of the drivenness, the harshness. She says, you know, I'm too hard on others. And he says, it's because you're so hard on yourself, and that's because you think God is looking at you with the same harshness that you're looking at yourself with, and he's not. He's looking at you with love. And so he begins to tell her, instead of running around looking for these holy heroics and these, you know, amazing penances and amazing good deeds, just settle down and do what God's putting right in front of you. Be cheerful when you're interrupted by one of your kids. Be kind to the very in-law who's driving you crazy. Shush your friends when they're bad-mouthing your in-laws. You know, pray, yes, but pray through your day. And don't stay up all night praying, because God needs you to get your sleep, because you got kids to take care of. And on and on. And so it's this very kind of common sense way, but for a perfectionist, it was a real challenge. Jane actually, in some ways, was better at doing the really outlandish things and the really driven things that she dreamed up herself than allowing herself to go with the more mundane penances and little trials of life that come from just living your own life. And as she began to accept those, though, as she begins to follow this way of what Francis calls the little virtues, we're talking simplicity, gentleness, meekness, charity, patience. And this is hard for a woman who likes to do everything yesterday. You know, come on, come on. She slows down and she begins to cultivate this. And over time, she grows into a paragon of holy gentleness. By the time she dies, she and Francis have started this religious order, the Visitation Order. The whole charism is gentleness and patience. And these are the two virtues Jane struggled with the most, and she becomes really emblematic of those. She gets people coming to her from all over. Whenever she tries to start a new convent, they're coming to her, princes and paupers alike, seeking her spiritual advice, and she always tells them the truth that really set her free, which is that the best way to learn patience in the spiritual life is to begin by being patient with yourself in all of your failures and feebleness of will, Jane says. So what I love about Jane is that she reminds us that to be patient, to be gentle, to be charitable, you don't have to have been born as this perfectly meek and charitable and easygoing person. You could be born type A and driven and still grow into this if you're willing to open your heart to God's healing grace and not just try to white-knuckle it and do it all yourself.
Colleen Carol Campbell, the author of The Heart of Perfection, and you really have to read this to know where she came from, not because it was a disastrous early life, but because it's a life that you might be able to identify with, and through her experiences in life and also through the lives of seven saints, she discovered a more comfortable way to be Colleen Carol Campbell. And by the way, Colleen, I don't have to tell you that you are now speaking to an international audience, but I ask you now, as a fellow broadcaster, to narrow that demographic down to one person who's out there listening right now, but who has lived a life of an absolute perfectionist, for whom, if it isn't 100% perfect, then it's a failure. Talk to that person, please, if you will, that one person, to perhaps provide a little of your comfort.
Yeah, well, that's a great, it's a challenge. I mean, I understand where that person is coming from. And, you know, it's interesting because I think the temptation for that person, for I think anyone in this situation, is to think, well, if I begin to go down this road toward healing, what I'm going to do is lose everything that defines me, my hunger for excellence, my longing to achieve great things for God. And that's not true. And that, for me, was one of the best revelations, and I think can be one of the spurs to healing for someone who is grappling with this right now, is to recognize you don't have to give up that longing for the perfect, because I believe that's a gift from God. I believe it's something he puts in the heart of every human being, that longing for something whole and complete and perfect, because I think that's our longing for him. And I think he put it there because he wants to satisfy it. Where we get into trouble is where we decide we're going to satisfy it on our terms or the world's terms, which will drive us crazy. But we don't have to give that up. And that's why a lot of the heart of perfection and the saint stories that I tell in the book is about learning how to trade our dream of perfect for God's, learning how to recognize that there's a difference between worldly perfectionism and what the saints would call gospel perfection. That is perfection by as God sees it, which again is not necessarily about flawlessness for us, but rather about perfect surrender, a perfect love. And we can't achieve all of this in this lifetime, and we certainly can't achieve it by ourselves, but we can begin to take steps toward it. And one of the first steps we can take is to recognize that I don't have to drop all of my idealism and my desire for excellence and everything I like about myself. That seeking healing from this doesn't mean I'm just going to slink back into mediocrity and just kind of be a big nobody. Because I think that's sometimes the fear. And I think that's where the saints are really helpful, because if you look at these different saints, these seven recovering perfectionist saints, they did extraordinary things. Sometimes they had more hidden gifts they offered the world, but in many cases they did transformative things in their communities, in their churches, on the world stage. And they did it not by leaning on their own strength, but by opening their hearts to God's healing grace in this area. And in terms of the first steps of that, I mean, I would always say prayer. I mean, I think daily prayer is a necessity if we want to seek healing from something like spiritual perfectionism. And I would also say recognizing the value of persistence, of I fell today, I'm going to get back up. I did that again, I'm going to ask forgiveness and keep going. On and on. Every moment of every day saying, yes, I recognize where I'm weak, where I've fallen, even where I'm falling into perfectionism again, and I'm not going to get stuck beating myself up or regretting all the times I've fallen in the past. I'm going to get back up, ask God's grace to move forward. And moving forward is really a key in this journey out of perfectionism.
Colleen, I'm going to introduce you to another of our listeners, another part of the world. And this is a person that has a very different reaction to what you've been saying. And this person wants to know, as a result of never feeling as if there has been anything even close to adequacy, much less perfection, how do you come to terms with a lack of perfection and appreciate yourself?
Well, I think, first of all, if you have the humility to recognize that you're a long way from the goal, I mean, that's the first step toward actually being on that road of gospel perfection. You know, humility is the building block of every virtue, and one of the most dangerous things about perfectionism is it tends to be rooted in pride, although it's a hidden pride. Most perfectionists wouldn't claim to have it all together, don't even think they have it all together, but they think they have the capacity to get it all together if they just work a little harder. So if you're actually at the point where you recognize, wow, I just don't have it in me to get it all together, I think you're actually, you're in a good place there. Because whenever we recognize our lack of self-sufficiency, I guess you would say, to perfect ourselves, to save ourselves, to be exactly who we want to be just on the basis of our own desire to be it, I think we're in a very good place, because we're in a place where our hearts are wide open for God's grace, wide open to receive the gifts others can offer us in journeying alongside us. I think that can be a very healing and good place to be. And again, I think it's important to recognize that perfectionism looks different in every life. And it may be that a lot of, you know, the out expressions of perfectionism don't sound familiar, but there might be one where it's actually a huge problem. And so I think really any of us could look in our lives, and there's probably at least one area of your life where you would say, yeah, I think I have some sort of addiction to control, or I'm sort of asking the impossible in that area of myself, and I'm beating myself up when I can't deliver that, or my sense of having to do it all myself is too strong in that one area. You know, it could be something trivial, but it could be something really close to your heart, something really painful, something left over from childhood. Maybe you're trying to get the approval of a critical parent who's never going to give it to you, or you're trying to, you know, overcome your own regret for some mistake you've long since, you know, tried to remedy and sought forgiveness for, but it's just always going to be there. And that's where, you know, the good news is those deep, deep wounds are the same places where the light breaks through, where God's grace breaks through. And so instead of hiding them and covering over them as perfectionists are wont to do, The real trick is to be willing to open them up to the light for healing.
But what if I don't feel I even have a relationship with God? And that has been also one of my areas of failure, at least by way of my own definition.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would only say that God wants a relationship with you. There's no one on this earth, I believe, that he didn't will here for a purpose because he loves you. I mean, he wills us into being with love. It begins in love. It ends, I believe, in love and the love of eternal union with God. And there's no one here he doesn't want a relationship with. I mean, if you crack the door just a bit to God, he is unscrupulous at how he will sneak right into your life. and just as close as he can get, he's a passionate lover, and he will stop at nothing to reach us. And if you're listening to this right now, that might be one of the ways that he's reaching out for you. And you know, the fact that you haven't reached back, it doesn't ever begin with us. I mean, at least the way I understand it, certainly my faith says that I can't do anything good starting with my own initiative. It always begins with the grace. So if you're longing for God, if there's some part of you that's longing for a relationship with him, to know just a little more about him, that's not a coincidence. He put that longing in your heart because he wants to fulfill it.
Far be it from me to ever think of Colleen some years ago as a perfectionist. I would never use that term. But as you were striving for excellence, and this is before marriage, and this is before you became a mom and got that humility thing together, did you ever find yourself meeting someone that you were in awe of because that person came closest to your definition of perfection? I don't mean the seven saints.
Certainly.
I don't mean the saints. I don't mean anyone on a level of divinity. I mean actually meeting someone.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I should stipulate that I haven't got the humility thing down or the recovery from perfectionism down. I am very much a work in progress, and I certainly don't want to claim to, you know, here, let me tell you how it's done, because I'm still figuring that one out. But and I'm still a perfectionist. I'm just in recovery, you know.
Yeah, well,
and I have my lapses.
What about husband John? Would he agree with that?
Well, I think so, absolutely. And my kids, too. You can ask them if I ever slip into perfectionism. Yeah, they do help for humility. But, you know, I have met people through my life who have inspired me, who have, oh, I think are living saints. And, you know, I think of them. They're often the most hidden people, people that are not famous. And, you know, an experience that I had that I wrote about a lot in my previous book, My Sisters the Saints, was my journey with my father through Alzheimer's disease. And, you know, as he journeyed through that, I really saw him transformed by God's grace and, yes, by what he suffered and what faith he hung on to through that suffering that really was luminous. I mean, by the end of his life, he was really just filled with the love of God. And it was something everyone noticed. I mean, he was at the late stages of dementia, so this is not someone who was giving soliloquies on God's grace, although he was certainly capable of that early in his life. He was a, you know, a great intellectual and a talented writer and all the rest of it. But by the end of his life, all that was really left was that faith, but it was so radiant and it was transformative for me. And that was really a crucial moment on my journey, not even a moment, I would say a whole stage of my life, where I gradually saw my faith-filled but very intelligent and sometimes proud father suffering through something that gradually sort of scraped off the layers of all those things we kind of accrue in life until really what was left was just this unconditional love of God, of my mother and brother and me, and this profound trust that he was in God's hands to his very last day, no matter how bad things got. And I still think about him all the time. And, you know, he's not going to be canonized. There are a lot of saints that aren't canonized. But I had a very strong sense that he was on his way straight to God when he finally slipped the surly bonds. It was about a decade ago when he finally died.
We're talking to Colleen Carol Campbell, the author of The Heart of Perfection. And she's already described herself as a kind of recovering perfectionist. who occasionally slips, according to John, her husband, and the four kids. But I'm going to ask you something before we have to leave, and we've got a few minutes left. Colleen, what was your most profound failure, and how did you deal with it?
Oh, gosh, that would take a little... As a perfectionist, I carry a list around with me. I'm trying to let them go. You know, I mean, this may seem a little vague, but I guess as I described in the book, I describe a moment where I kind of came face to face with my perfectionism. I was marching a child into the ER, and it was some freak accident that had happened on my watch. And at that point, I probably would have told you it was that, you know, I wasn't watching closely enough and my kid fell or whatever. And that was my failure. But more and more, as I look over my life, it's probably really just been my failures to trust God fully. I mean, I believe that God is good. I say it like everyone else, but I also struggle, especially when I'm in a tight spot and it seems like I've been praying and praying for this and you're not answering my prayer, or come on, I thought you wanted this and it doesn't seem like you're, it seems like you've gone absent. And, you know, we all go through these times. And for me, when I look back on my life and the amazing things that God has done for me, starting with the fact that I have four children, because for many years I thought I'd never be able to have children at all. It's that forgetfulness of God's mercy and grace to me, that lack of trust. And I still struggle with that today. You know, he can do amazing things for me today, and tomorrow I'm going, well, what about today? I mean, are you, did you forget me? Are you over here? So, you know, I'm grateful he puts up with me anyway. But I would say, in terms of failures in life, I guess after researching and writing The Heart of Perfection, I'm less focused on specific things I might have done wrong than in my lack of trust in God and his mercy for each time I thought I've screwed this up or you're not here to catch me when I fall. And I forgot all the times he has been there for me, which means all the times he's going to be there for me in the future, because I'm going to mess up plenty more times in the future. I just hope in the future I'm better able to remember the great things he's done for me in the past and the mercy that he's shown me, and maybe hang on a little longer. I don't know, because I am fickle and I'm prone to doubting his goodness every time, you know, I hit a tight spot. But I do try to remember that he loves me so much. He loves each of us so much, and he'd do anything for us. He died for us. And that's certainly, as a Christian, a consolation to me to remember that he's always there. And even when I can't see him or feel him, he's always there.
Okay, I've decided after 56 minutes of conversation with Colleen Carroll Campbell, this is the moment that I haven't ever shared with the audience, but I think it's time. I'm going to ask them now not to listen to Colleen's next answer, because it's so personal. So everyone, everywhere in the world is listening to The God Show. Don't turn the radio off. Don't turn off your electronic device, whatever it is that you're using to listen. Just leave the room temporarily. Because I want to ask you, Colleen, if having learned all of these things from your family members, from your kids, from your husband, from your associates, from those seven saints, come on, just you and me, tell me, just Pat, privately, don't you sometimes look in the mirror and say, you're pretty hot stuff, Colleen?
Oh, no, and I certainly hope I haven't given that impression. If so, I have completely...
Okay, everybody can listen again. You can listen to Colleen.
Oh, no. No, just hang out with me for a day, Pat. You'll if you have any illusions that I'm over here walking on water, my kids will set you straight, and if they don't, you'll see it for yourself. No, I am quite the flawed work in progress. What I'm learning to do is stop punishing myself for that, and accept that God sees it and he loves me anyway. So who am I to decide I'm not worthy of his love? That seems to me even more proud and presumptuous.
How old are your kids?
9, 9, 7, and 5.
Okay. 5-year-old comes in tears. Mommy, I wanted to do this, whatever this was, and it was the most important thing to me, and I failed. I was terrible at it. I flunked. What do you say to her?
I just give him a huge hug and tell him I'm sorry, and I love him. And I think that's the value of parenting. You know, if we look at our kids that way, why on earth would God be looking at us with condemnation at our weakest moment? And that's the great gift I think my kids have given me, is recognizing that if I can see to do that for my child, how much more can God see to do that for me? That in my moments of failure and weakness, he's not looking at me with screeching hatred for my mistakes. He's just looking at me with love. And, you know, he's just there with me. I try to do that for my kids. I probably do it imperfectly, but I know God does it for me perfectly.
If I want to get better acquainted,
try to point my kids to them.
If I want to get better acquainted with Colleen Carroll Campbell and those seven saints that you have really described beautifully in the book, The Heart of Perfection, is there a secret to finding the book, or is it like everything else on the planet available at Amazon?
It is. The Heart of Perfection is on Amazon and Barnes & Noble, but you can find it at a lot of indies, too. And, my website, colleen-campbell.com, has all the buy-now links, too. But, yes, The Heart of Perfection is pretty much available everywhere these days.
And as I tried to achieve a level of perfection this hour with my guest, Colleen Carroll Campbell, I failed miserably. However, she brought me up to a higher standard than I thought I was capable of. And I thank you, Colleen Carroll Campbell, on The God Show, and everyone else. If you really want to discover the reality of how close to perfection you can get by listening to The God Show, it's available all the time on the StarWorldWideNetworks.com. Nice to have you with us.